Okay, so this whole semester we've been talking about bonds, really, right? And what you can figure out about bonds and what they tell you about the way the molecules are shaped and how they behave. Are the bonding models we've been talking about, these models of structure, realistic in detail? Not only in general that there are right-handed and left-handed things, but precisely where the atoms are. And as we started talking about last time, X-ray diffraction is the place to find that. And there are more than 50 million bonds whose geometry has been determined precisely from 36 million atomic positions. And even without that, even earlier in 1985 or 1986, there were already enough to do a good statistical analysis to see how reproducible bonds are. So the question is, are bond lengths standard, say within plus or minus 1%? Okay. So there was this paper in 1987 from the people at the Cambridge Crystallographic Data Center, which attempted to do that. And here's the beginning of that curve of how many structures they have in their database. At that time, they had 6,000 structures, but that's still a lot of bonds, right? So they tried to see how they could classify bonds so that if you knew a bond in one molecule, you'd know precisely the distance in another molecule. But in order to do that, they had to have a number of different types of bonds, which would have slightly different distances, right? So this table on the left shows the number of average, of mean bond lengths, not the number of bonds, but how many classifications they had. And it specialized because, of course, neighbors influence the precise bond distance. So, for example, if we look here, we see that there are 119 in their classification different types of bonds between carbon and oxygen, right, in order to get good precision. So you can go from one molecule to the next and be confident that within 1% they'll be the same. Or, you can see this broken down on the right, of the 119 types of CO bonds, there are bonds with sp3 carbons on the top, then with sp2 carbons, then with aromatic carbons, and finally, with sp-squared hybridized carbons that have double bonds to oxygen, carbonyl groups. There are 38 different kinds of carbonyl groups that they had to identify in order to get really good reproducibility. Okay, and of carbon-nitrogen, they had 97 different kinds of bonds, including, you know, single, double, triple. And of carbon-carbon, they had 175 different kinds of carbon-carbon bonds. Now, let's look at what those are. Some of them, there are 27 different types of carbon-carbon bonds in which the carbons are both sp3 hybridized. Obviously, if you have different hybridization of carbons, you expect different distances because the orbitals extend more or less, as we know. But even if it's sp3, they saw 27 different kinds. So here are those 27 different kinds of sp3 carbon. And this particular entry here is a single bond between two sp3 carbons, and that asterisk means that the carbon doesn't have oxygen, nitrogen, chlorine, or something like that on it. The only three other things that carbon has on it are either other carbons or hydrogen, right? And you can see in that case that the mean bond distance is 1.53 angstroms, right? So 1.5, but if you want to be precise, 1.53. And the median is also 1.53. And the standard deviation is 0.015. That's 1% of 1.5. So it's within 1%. And you notice that's based on 5,777 examples of such of CC single bonds between sp3 carbons. Now, however, that's a little bit misleading that it's so precise, because notice that of those 5,777, practically all of them came from three particular kinds, which occurred very often in molecules that whose X-ray structure was determined. Right? So those by far bias it. And it could be that there are others which actually are different, but they have a very low representation. So the statistics are misleading in the sense that you couldn't predict those others. So let's look at some of the others. For example, up here at the top, we see CH2 to CH3, the bold face shows where the bond is between those two carbons. But this carbon is bonded to C pound sign, which means any sp3 carbon. So it's any sp3 carbon, then CH2, then CH3. So it's an ethyl group at the end of a chain. Right? Okay. Or you can have an ethyl group, a group that has two of those other carbons on it, or one that has three of the other carbons on it and then goes off to a methyl group. Now let's look up here. It's 1.51, 1.52, 1.53. Right? Now, can you see a reason why that might be? Why does the bond get longer? Reproducibly, notice that the difference is in this, the standard deviation is 0.01. So these differences are at the border, and I'll show you a plot in a second of what's of the significance of the data. So there's a significant data difference between this bond, and this bond, and its difference. Why? It is distance. Why? Anybody got an idea why the bond gets longer as you go from having one to two to three other carbons, the rest being hydrogen on the central carbon? Yeah? Right, it just gets bigger and pushes the methyl group away, the other groups that are attached to that carbon, it would appear. So crowding stretches the bond, right? And it's significant given what the standard deviations are. So we can draw curves that show this kind of these various averages with these standard deviations. And you can see there's a significant difference, especially between the blue and the red. They have a little bit of overlap, but there's certainly, if you wanted to be precise in making your prediction of distance, you'd choose differently according to how crowded this carbon is. Okay? Or if we go down a little further, where both the carbons on both ends of the bond we're interested in are substituted, two on each end, two on one end, three on the other, or three on both ends. And now you notice there's quite a difference, 1.54, 1.56 really, and 1.59 average, although there are only 21 examples at that time of this kind of very heavily substituted carbon-carbon bond. And if we draw those curves, you see how very different those are from the others. So there are significant differences depending on the neighbors. If it gets crowded, the bond stretches a little bit. On the other hand, if you put it into a ring, into the carbon-carbon bond in a three-membered ring or a four-membered ring, notice this one is significantly short, 1.51. Whereas the four-membered ring is significantly long, 1.55, right? So it is possible to know from precedent where bonds are likely to be in their distance, but to do that, you have to take the environment into account, right? It's not every single carbon-carbon single bond isn't the same. Okay, and then, of course, it's even different if you have sp3 with sp2 carbons, as in the examples here. So here's 1.50, 1.50, 1.51, 1.52 as it gets more and more crowded. Same idea. Okay, so in general, you can say that carbon-carbon single bonds are about 1.53, but they respond to the environment. Double bonds, 1.32. Triple bonds are 1.18. So there's a big difference between single, double, and triple. And aromatic bonds are in between single and double, 1.38. And the single bonds change if you change the hybridization. So an sp3 to sp2 single bond is 1.50, and an sp2 single bond, 1.46. So there are differences. And there's some really interesting differences, as in this bond between nitrogen and an aromatic carbon ring. What do you notice that's funny about that distribution? Yeah. Pardon me? Right. It's bimodal. There must be two different populations that are contributing to this. So what? How do you recognize when it should be shorter and when it should be longer? Well, what they noticed was that if you took only cases where the bonds to the nitrogen were coplanar, it fit a pretty good Gaussian type of distribution. Or if you took the ones where it was pyramidal, it was pretty normal distribution. But if you put the two together here, you see two different humps, because the planar ones are shorter than the pyramidal ones. Now, why should that be? Well, notice that if it's planar, you have overlap between the p-orbital electrons here, high HOMO, and low LUMOs involving the double bonds in the ring, right? So you get that HOMO-LUMO mixing and a partial double bond between the nitrogen and the carbon. But you get that only when the nitrogen is, the bonds are planar, so you have the p-orbital here, not something that points in the wrong direction. On the other hand, if the nitrogen is bent like this, then you don't have overlap, and in fact it twists. So these two groups on the nitrogen don't interact with the planar ring here. And now it's a pure single bond. So it twists and you get poor pi overlap, right? So these are longer and these are partially double bonds. So you can learn something about what's going on by seeing funny distributions in this, using the statistics from these many, many crystal structures. As far as I know, this precise thing hasn't been repeated with the whole database now that's up to 50 million bonds. It would be fun to do it again and see whether all these things bear out. But it's already based on quite a few examples. So does it say how many here? It doesn't say, but there were quite a few. Okay, so how complex must a model be if you want to predict useful structures? Obviously, you can't use, as model sets like this have, you can't use just one value for the single bond. To get standard deviations in bond distance of 1%, the people at Cambridge had to have 175 different kinds of carbon-carbon bonds differing in multiplicity, single, double, triple, hybridization, sp3, sp2, sp, which groups are attached, whether they're in rings, and so on. Okay, they had 97, as we said, different types of CN bonds, 119 CO bonds, 682 kinds of bonds altogether, right? But if you take this, then you can make predictions within 1% of the bond distance and be confident of that. Now, so much for structure. Now we're going on to the next thing that we'd like to do with our model, because we want to understand all molecules, their properties, and their transformations. So we want to understand reactivity as well as shape. And we've done some of this already in terms of HOMOs and LUMOs and what would make things reactive. But that's going to be the main subject next semester. This semester is mostly about structure. So the key for structure has been bonds, right? Well, one could say the key nowadays is quantum mechanics. Right? You do quantum mechanics, very few assumptions, and nowadays you can get pretty good results for simple structures, that is up to, you know, 50 atoms maybe or something like that. And we showed the example of something that was really humongous that was actually done, although it took forever to do it. Okay, but it's much simpler to deal with bonds, right, rather than to have to do quantum mechanics. And we've seen that you can do structure in terms of bonds and be confident within 1%, and then use molecular mechanics to do twists about bonds to find the lowest energy structure. So structure is pretty good now in terms of bonds, although you use a lot of parameters in molecular mechanics and you use a lot of bond types in the stuff we've just been talking about with the from X-ray, right? But the other key, especially to understanding reactivity, is energy. And so the question arises, can obviously use quantum mechanics to calculate energy. Can we use bonds to calculate energy? Okay, so there must be corrections, obviously. We know for conformation, we've been talking about the energy change as you rotate about bonds, and strain. But is there some underlying energy that comes from the composition? If you knew what atoms are in there, would you know roughly what the energy of the molecule was? Or if you knew the constitution, what the bonds were, the nature and sequence of bonds, would you have a really good first approximation of the energy, which you then could tune a little bit with molecular mechanics in terms of strain? Okay, so the question is, are bond energies as standard as bond distances are? Okay, can we have a table of bond energies and add them up to get the energy of a molecule, or for purposes of reaction, a piece of a molecule, how much energy it would take to break a molecule apart so you can rearrange it? Okay? Well, this is an old problem. In 1868, already, in the second paper, paper number two, that was published in the newsletter of the German Chemical Society, this is the very first issue, the second paper, had to do with this very subject. Notice is only 10 years after the idea of bonds, Cooper and Kekulé. Okay? So Ludomar Hermann wrote this paper on the regularity and calculation of heats of combustion, that is, energy content, of organic compounds. He said, by a frequently expressed need of physiology, he was a physiologist, to be able to calculate heats of combustion, I have been led to study the current situation. I mean, this is what, there was a thing in the Times, I think, on Sunday, about Weight Watchers having adjusted the point values of various foods for purposes of their clients, right? So the heat content, how many calories there are in a bowl of lettuce or mayonnaise or whatever, is of big interest, and it was of interest already then. Okay, so could you, by looking at a molecule and seeing what bonds are in it, predict its heat of combustion, how much energy value it has? And in fact, a later publication in the same year by Adolf Oppenheim was on the same subject, the relationship of heat of combustion with the constitution of substances, right? He didn't have as specific a meaning of constitution as we do, but it's the word we want to use, the nature and sequence of bonds. Can we add bonds together and get what the heat of combustion should be? Well, let's try. So can we get the heat of combustion, how much heat is given off by burning, just from the composition, from how much carbon and hydrogen is in there, how much fuel? Okay, so we can start with the pure elements, graphite and hydrogen, and take a mole of it, okay? And how many hydrogen atoms per mole there are. Okay, and we find that the heat of combustion for graphite is 94 minus 94. That is, it gets more stable. The heat, the energy content goes down when you burn it. It gives off energy. So this is favorable, right? Minus 94.05 per atom in graphite. Minus 57.8, right, for hydrogen. But there are two H's in hydrogen. This is a molecule. This is, of course, a solid, so you have to do some fiddling to figure out what you mean by a mole of it. So we mean a mole of atoms, and this a mole of hydrogen is actually two atoms. Okay, so that's per H2. Okay, now, so if you had ethene, which is C2H4, that would be twice this, because there are two carbons, and twice 57.8, because there are four hydrogens, right? Hydrogen atoms, okay? So you add twice this, and you'd predict, if it were just additive in terms of how many atoms were there, just the composition, you'd get minus 303.7, and the actual value is really pretty close, right? Just how many atoms are there? Minus 316.2, right? Now, there's an error of 12.5 kilocalories per mole, but that's only 4%. Pretty good for such a really simple model, just what atoms are in there. Of course, why should there be an error at all? What it says is that it gives off more heat than you expected, right? So it was higher in energy than you expected. It had more energy to give off. Why? Can you see a reason why ethene, the CC with a CC double bond, might have unusually high energy? Yeah.
Because it's not just an H2 bond, it's a CH bond and
a
CC bond.
It's not so much the CH bonds, although that would be a factor, because one of them has sp squared, the other has sp3 to H. But that would make a stronger bond. In ethene, it's sp squared. That would be a stronger CH bond, would make the starting material more stable and have less energy to give off when it burned. So that particular thing about the CH bond would go in the wrong direction. But the CC bond is a double bond. It's not two single bonds, right? And the second bond, the pi bond, isn't as strong as a single bond. So you expect it to be higher in energy, so that's hardly surprising, Right? That's what we say here. It has extra energy to give off. One of its bonds not so stabilizing, so it starts at an unusually high energy. But does it work for other molecules? Okay, how about cyclohexane? So it's got 6 carbons, 12 hydrogens, so we add together on that basis and we get 911, but it's actually 881. So that's off by 29.5 kilocalories, which is even better in the sense that in a percentage basis it's better. Right? But if we go to cyclohexanol, it has the same number of carbon and hydrogens as cyclohexane. It just has an oxygen inserted in one of the CH bonds. And now it's 842 and we're off by 8%. And in the case of glucose, which is the same thing again, except we've inserted 6 oxygen atoms in bonds, right? It now is off by 36%. So that's not so great anymore. And why? Because those last two with oxygens in them are, in a sense, partially burned already, right? Because combustion is combination with oxygen. We've already put some of the oxygen in when we start with those. So we don't expect to get as much heat out. And indeed, we don't. We get 240 kilocalories less than we expected on the basis of how much carbon and hydrogen there. But perhaps you could correct for that. This isn't too bad for fuel purposes. I mean, even 8% isn't too bad, especially if you were to include some kind of a correction when there's partial oxidation, right? So not too bad for fuel purposes. But how complex a model would you... So that's a very, very simple model. But how complex would a model have to be if you wanted to predict energies that were chemically useful? Now we have to decide how precise we have to be chemically useful. So for physiology purposes, the ones that were originally important or might be important for the Weight Watchers people, you might be content if you have within 5%, right? But if you're predicting the equilibrium constant between cyclohexane for its oxidation, so cyclohexane plus a half O2 and cyclohexanol, which would be the product of that reaction, if you're off by 1%, that means you're off by 9 kilocalories per mole. And that means you're off in predicting the equilibrium constant, which is the sort of thing you're really interested in. Right? Remember, you can use energy to predict an equilibrium constant. Now, how far off are you going to be in an equilibrium constant if you're off by 9 kilocalories per mole in the energy? How much does 9 kilocalories per mole contribute as a factor to an equilibrium constant? How do you go from energy to equilibrium constant? It's a quiz here. How do you do it? If you know the energy difference, how do you know the equilibrium constant? 10 to the 3/4, right? So it's going to be off by a factor of 10 to the 3/4 of 9. So you're going to be off by 10 million fold in predicting the equilibrium constant. That's not very useful. Okay. A useful model must go beyond just what atoms are there. You're going to have to do it better than that. So how about constitution? Can we do it if we know what bonds are there? Well, energy is the key to understanding equilibrium and also rates, kinetics. So let's look in the case of cyclohexane at its energy. So there's the energy of cyclohexane, that line. Now, compared to what? What's going to be zero on our scale? Okay, well, the zero is arbitrary because things we're going to be interested in are differences in energy between starting material and products, right? The equilibrium constant has to do with the difference in energy. We don't care whether the zero of the scale is up here or down here. All we're interested in is the difference between two things, which one is better. So, in fact, you could define the zero to be any place you wanted it to be, and you'd get all the same differences. So what you do is choose a convenient value, a convenient place for zero. So what would be convenient, right? For purposes of combustion, a convenient point of comparison is CO2 and water. Why? That is, there's a certain amount of carbon in here, a certain amount of hydrogen. This, if you took the same amount of carbon and of hydrogen here in the form of CO2 and H2O, they would have a certain energy. Why would that be a convenient point of comparison.
Those are
the products of combustion, right? So if you do complete combustion, so you get CO2 and H2O and measure the heat given off, the number you get is this number, because you're comparing it to the products. Okay, and it turns out that, the heat of combustion of cyclohexane is 881.6 kilocalories per mole. Negative, that means it went down in energy. It's favorable. Okay, now, and that's easily measured, so that's the virtue of choosing that as zero. On the other hand, another possible choice would be the elements in their standard states. So carbon is graphite, hydrogen is hydrogen gas at one atmosphere, and so on, room temperature. Okay, so if in that case, this difference there would be the energy of cyclohexane, if we chose that as zero, and that's called the heat of formation. Right? This is the heat of combustion. This is the heat of formation. How much energy do you get out if you make the compound from graphite and hydrogen? Okay? That's much harder to do experimentally. Okay? How could you measure it? How could you measure the heat of formation? That's not a reaction you can do. You can mix graphite and hydrogen. If you put a catalyst in, you can make them react. But you won't only get cyclohexane. You'll get all sorts of different stuff. So how could you measure that tiny energy difference experimentally? You could burn graphite and hydrogen, see how much heat they give off, and then the difference is that heat of formation. Right? So there's a great experimental way to do it. Okay. And it turns out that the heat of formation of cyclohexane is -29.5, which has the virtue compared to 881.6 that it's a much smaller number, easier to manage. Okay? So at the appendix of this book, Streitwiser and Hethcock, a book we've used as text and some of you have, they give the heat of formation, that is the energy of these molecules in the gas phase at 25 degrees compared to the elements in their standard state. And cyclohexane must be here. Here are cycloalkanes, cyclohexane -29.5. That's the one we just talked about. But here are all different ones, so that you can see then in going from one set of molecules to another, how much energy do you have at the beginning? How much energy do you have at the end? Is it going to be favorable or unfavorable, the reaction? What will the equilibrium constant be? So that's handy to have tables like this. So there are all sorts of molecules. It's alkanes, cycloalkanes, alkenes, alkynes, aromatic hydrocarbons, alcohols, ethers, aldehydes, oxygen compounds, nitrogen compounds, halogen compounds, sulfur compounds, inorganic compounds. And notice here, atoms and radicals, right? Cations and anions. Why would you be interested in those? You can't put those in a bottle. Why would you be interested in their energy? Pardon me, Christine? Right. In the process of a reaction, you may be breaking a thing in to get pieces, and you need to know how much energy you need to put in to cause that to happen. So for purposes of reactions, you need to know the energies of molecular fragments. Good, but let's go back and look at the alkanes and cycloalkanes, and in particular at the concept of group additivity. So instead of using bonds, and we'll look at that next, but another way of doing it is to use groups of atoms and see if you can add it up based on that. Let me show you what we mean. So take ethane, for example. Its heat of formation is -20.2. Okay, we'll just denote it by a line. And then we look at the next one, which is propane, which is the same thing, except it has a CH2 group inserted. So how much heat of formation did we get by inserting a CH2 group into a carbon-carbon bond, right? The difference between those two is 4.6. So a CH2 group, a group additivity, the group is worth 4.6. Now, what would you check next? Yeah. Chris? Put another CH2 in the middle. Okay? So if we go to butade, we've got 2, so we've added another one, and that difference is 5.6. So similar. Okay? Let's do another one. 4.7, another one 4.8, right? The average is 4.9, right? Pretty good. This one's a little funny, and I don't know why, to tell you the truth. But it looks like it's 4.9 for every CH2 group. So you could predict a chain, you know, that was 100, 102 carbons long, right? It's whatever ethane is plus 100 times this, okay? 510.2, I would predict. Got the idea? Okay, now let's check the group additivity, that idea, for cycloalkanes, right? The two-membered ring, three-membered ring, four-membered ring, right? So these are just sets of CH2 groups. So now we should be able to use that value we had and find these out. So these are the heat of formation of these various compounds, and we can see how many, divide it by how many CH2 groups there are, N, right? And we get the heat of formation per CH2 group. Now, what would we have expected it to be from our previous slide? Remember the value for CH2 groups, inserting it in the chain? 4.9. So a lot of them are pretty close to that, but this is the plot of it. Here's 5, right? So some of them are quite, it's minus 5 actually, it's favorable, right, compared to the elements. Okay, but some of them are unfavorable. So why do you get these funny shapes? Any idea? Why do you get a funny shape, say, in ethylene is something special, right? That's, calling it a two-membered ring is sort of silly, right? But a three-membered ring, you can call a three-membered ring. What would Bayer say about it? Yeah? It's strained. It looks like these are strained, right? But then it becomes unstrained, then it becomes strained again, and then it becomes unstrained. That looks sort of funny. Okay, so this one, the six-membered ring, cyclohexane, is a minimum, right? 4.9, exactly the value we expect, right, from a straight chain. Okay, so that's unstrained, the same as a chain, right? And these, once you get up to 12 or 13 or 14 or 15 or 16, it looks like it's pretty close to that. But the strainless theory would be 2 times minus 4.9, minus 9.8 here, and corresponding values here. Right? But we can say that the difference between our strainless theory of minus 4.9 per CH2 group and what's actually observed, we can call that the total strain energy. Remember, Bayer talked about strain in terms of reactivity. Here we're talking about it in terms of energy. Right? And here is our, we define that as zero. Right? And then there's energy here and energy here. So the energy up here is small ring strain, that the bond angles aren't right, you don't get good overlap. We understand that. And in fact, in cyclopentane, remember, we analyzed that in some detail. If it were planar, it would have the normal bond angles, but then you have this eclipsing strain around the periphery, so it puckers into that envelope, as we talked about last time. Okay, so there are various kinds of strain, but in general, you call it small ring strain. But you also have this strain here, which is called transannular strain. And I'm going to show you what's involved here, if you can see it. So here's cyclohexane, right? Viewed along its axis. And if I tilt it up like that, you can see what it's like. But if I make, and remember that cyclohexane here is unstrained, right? Where are we here? Yeah. But cycloheptane is strained. Why is cycloheptane strained? Here I've made a model, or almost made a model of cycloheptane, except what you can't see is that there's supposed to be another hydrogen in there. Right? And I couldn't make it. Right? So here's cyclohexane, cyclooctane. Actually, did I make? I forget whether what I have here is heptane or octane, but it's the same idea either way. But if it's an octane, those two hydrogens get very close to one another across the ring, transannular, right? If we make a space-filling model of it, it looks like that. Crunch, right? So it's not adjacent things that are running into one another, but ones across the ring for these medium sizes. So I'll pass these two around. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, it is 8 that I made here, not heptane. So there's cyclohexane, right? And compare that one, and you need to get another hydrogen into that hole. No room at the end. Okay. So group additivity seems to work, at least in these cases. How about bond additivity? Can we add bonds together? Well, that same book has Appendix 3, is average bond energies. Somebody thought it was useful to compile such a table, which suggests that it is, in principle, possible to do this. Or in fact, if they made this table. So let's look at this. Notice that for a carbon-carbon bond, these are values. Notice that many of them, many familiar ones, are more or less something like 100 kilocalories per mole, or a little bit smaller for when other atoms are involved. But here's hydrogen, carbon, dioxide, fluorine, same things across here. So a carbon-hydrogen bond is 104. A hydrogen-hydrogen is 104. Hydrogen-carbon is 99. Carbon-carbon is 83, it says, but it's got a footnote. It says that if it's a double bond, it's 146, and if it's a triple bond, it's 200. And analogous things for single, double, triple for carbon-nitrogen or carbon-oxygen for single and double. So the question is, how well can we do with this? Can we sum these bond energies to get useful heats of what? If you broke all the bonds, what would you have? You'd have atoms, right? Not combustion, which is easy to do, not heat of formation from the elements in their standard states, which is impossible to do, but easy to do experiments that give it to you. Now, if we're talking in terms of adding bonds together, our point of reference must be the atoms all separated from one another. That's going to be a really, really tough experiment to do in either direction, breaking the thing into atoms or having atoms come together to form this particular molecule. You can't really do it. So how well can bond energies predict heat of atomization? Where does the heat of atomization come from experimentally? Well, we had this thing where we saw where we got heat of combustion and heat of formation. Heat of atomization is way the heck up there, right, compared to these others. It's on scale here. Okay, there's the heat of atomization. Now, how can you measure it? How could you measure the heat of atomization? The distance to start from the compound of interest to get up to separated atoms. Remember, we couldn't do the heat of formation either, this one, but we could do it indirectly by going that way to get between the two, if we knew this heat of combustion and that heat of combustion. Can you see what key experiment you might want to do? Yeah? Can't hear very well, Carl.
Could we do a synthesis of CO2 and H2O?
From what? If you could get CO2 and H2O, from the atoms, right? Then you could do it. But how are you going to get, if you bring carbon atoms and hydrogen atoms together, they're not going to give just CO2 and H2O. They're going to give all sorts of different things. Okay? Any other ideas? Yeah? If you broke apart CO2 to get carbon and two oxygens, broke apart H2O to get two hydrogens and an oxygen, then you'd know this energy difference. Or you could start here. If you could break H2 apart and see how much energy difference there is between H2 and the atoms, or if you could take an atom out of graphite, a carbon atom out of graphite, see how much energy it takes to boil graphite, right, to get carbon, then you would know it. So if you could do it that way, right? For example, if you knew that the heat of atomization of graphite and hydrogen for this many carbons and that many hydrogens was 1650.6, right? Then you would know this value over here. It would be just the sum of all those things, or difference, whatever you call it. It would be 680.1 would be the heat of atomization. And that then should be the sum of 6 carbon-carbon bonds and 12 carbon-hydrogen bonds. Got the idea? What do you think of the tough experiment to do here? The tough experiment is to get the heat of atom. Hydrogen is a pretty simple thing. You could imagine doing hydrogen. Graphite is something else again. So let's look at that. How can you know the heat of formation for atoms? Well, from spectroscopy, you know that if you have some diatomic molecule, it's down here and it's 0 point, the lowest possible vibrational energy. And if you put light in it, energy, and you put just enough to make the thing break and measure how much light energy that is, what the color of the light is, then you know that difference. Right? So from spectroscopy, it was figured out that the breaking the hydrogen-hydrogen bond is 104.2 kilocalories per mole, or the heat of formation of hydrogen is half that for a single hydrogen atom, 52.1, because the hydrogen gas is the standard state for H2. Okay? Now, you could do the same thing for O2, right? Find out how much energy you need to break O2 into two oxygen atoms, and you find that per oxygen atom it's 59.6. The heat of formation of oxygen is zero, so we know it's the heat of its atoms. We could do CO, and now from that we can get the heat of oxygen. We form an oxygen atom, which we already got here, and a carbon atom. And it's known that the energy put in order to break the bond is 257.3 kilocalories per mole. So the heat of formation of CO is minus 26.4 compared to graphite and oxygen. That's measured, as we said before, by combustion of those two, right? So now we know where the heat of formation of oxygen from this experiment. So we know what the heat of formation of carbon is. Looks great, except there was a problem. The problem is that there were a number of Nobel laureates who wrote the standard textbooks on this kind of thing, who worried that this light, the light of this color, was not in fact doing what they showed here. They worried that it was giving a more excited state of the molecule and giving one of the atoms in a higher energy level, not its lowest energy level. Right? So if you assume that this energy was not the blue one, but in fact the red one, then the atom is, it doesn't take as much energy to make the atom as you thought it did. So instead of 171, it would be 141. Or it could even have been another excited state of the atom, in which case it would have been 125. So this is interesting, and it's not uncommon in the case of spectroscopy. You can measure something really, really precisely, but you're not quite sure what you measured. Okay? So the spectroscopic value is precise, but it's uncertain, and this was a big uncertainty. And it was settled in the early 1950s by a really surprising way, right? Remember, the equilibrium constant is this at room temperature, 10 to the minus 3/4 delta H. So if you measured K, you would find the difference in energy. So they measured the equilibrium constant for forming atoms from graphite. Okay. Now, the heat of formation of a carbon atom from graphite is 170. So the equilibrium constant is 10 to the minus 127. Right? That there are only about 10 to the 80th atoms in the universe, it's estimated. Right? So obviously if you had all the carbon in the universe, you wouldn't have at room temperature a single atom. It'd all be graphite. Okay? But that's at room temperature, right? Where the denominator here is 300 Kelvin. If instead of 300 Kelvin, you went to 3,000 Kelvin, then it would be 3/40 instead of 3/4. And now it would be 10 to the 13th, the equilibrium constant. Now there's a possibility of actually measuring something. So what do you have to do in order to measure the equilibrium constant to get the energy difference between graphite and carbon? You have to heat it up to something of the order of 3,000 Kelvin. Right? That's pretty hot. They didn't go quite that hot. But the idea is that the concentration, whatever you mean by concentration of the atom, that's okay in the gas phase, but the concentration of graphite is not so easy to define. Okay? But anyhow, it will be proportional to the heat of formation of carbon divided by the gas constant, T, e to the exponential. What do we mean by that? Well, we don't have to know what that is. We could write it, the pressure of the carbon atom is proportional to concentration. So the pressure of carbon, if we could measure the pressure of the carbon atom, it's some constant, B, that involves what we mean by concentration of graphite, times this. So that if we take the log of both sides, measure the log of the pressure, it's the log of B, which we don't know, and then this, right? But if we then make a plot of these two, of 1 over temperature versus the log of the pressure of the carbon atom, the slope of that plot, that log versus 1 over T plot, the slope is the thing we want, delta H for formation of the atom. So you don't really have to define what you mean by the concentration of graphite. All you have to do is see how the pressure changes as you increase the temperature, but it has to be a very high temperature in order to get any pressure of carbon atoms at all. So, now I'm at the end of the time, but let me just go through this really quickly. Can we do that, or do you want to do it? Either this lecture or the next one, I'm going to have a few more minutes. Or we can do it on Friday. What's your preference? I don't know what you're saying. You got things to do now? Okay, we'll do the perils of Pauline here. Incidentally, there's a lecture on Friday. There's a lecture on Wednesday. On Friday, we'll meet here at the normal time, but it'll be mostly a review session. Maybe I'll have a few slides that I haven't gotten to. Okay? And then next week, I'll have a review session Wednesday evening, not this week, but next week. And we'll talk with the TAs about when would be good for you guys to get together. Okay, we'll do that on Wednesday. Okay, so Chupka and Ingram devised this oven to heat graphite up a lot. So this is the diagram from their paper. So in this little can in the middle, there was a liner of graphite. That's going to be what we're going to boil, essentially. Okay? And it's surrounded by a can made of tantalum. Now, tantalum has a really high melting point, 3,293 Kelvin, right? You couldn't use many materials here. Okay, now they put two loops of wire outside this can, and they connected the can to a wires down here and this thing to a wire, and they put a heck of a lot of voltage on it, right? First, they heated this wire very hot, right? So electrons would boil off. And then they would be accelerated by the potential difference. The electrons would bombard the tantalum can and heat it hot, very hot. Okay, so they're going to heat this can, which means they heat the graphite liner inside, heat it up to thousands of degrees Kelvin in order to boil off carbon atoms. I say boil, it doesn't, graphite doesn't melt, right? It just sublimes. Okay, now, then, so there's inside this thing at equilibrium with the graphite is a gas composed of carbon. It's not just the things in the gas phase are not just C, they're also C2, C3, C60, buckyballs, you know about that, C70, and so on. But lots of different gaseous forms of carbon in there. Then they drill a tiny hole here that lets just a little bit of the gas escape very slowly. Right? You don't want much of it to escape or it'll cool. Right, you want to maintain equilibrium inside here so that what comes off is a sample of the carbon gas, various carbon, CN, right, at whatever temperature the oven is at. So just a tiny hole. These gas phase things, for carbons, that's all that's inside is carbon. This is all evacuated, of course. Okay, the carbon comes out through here, and here it meets a beam of electrons that knock electrons out of the carbon, right? So now you have ions instead of carbon, a neutral carbon. And then you have voltages here that accelerate those ions, right? So now those things have velocity because having charge, you can make them zoom by putting different potentials on. So they're coming out of here, and then you put a magnet here, which causes them to bend. But the heavier they are, the less they bend. right? So now you put a detector out here and see how much C3, how much C2, how much C1 is coming out. And that's going to be proportional to how much C3, how much C2, how much C1 was in the gas here. All you need is something that's proportional, because you're going to make this plot to see how that changes with temperature. All you need is something that's proportional to the amount of gas. You don't have to measure exactly how much gas there is, just something that's proportional to it. Okay, and now, if this is going to be really hot, you want the heat to stay inside here, not to heat up your laboratory with it. Okay, so they put concentric cans around it that are, this one's really hot, this one's pretty hot, this one's awfully hot, but not as hot as the others, and so on, so that all the heat doesn't get out. Okay, and then they drill a tiny hole through here and have here glass, actually not glass, it's quartz. They couldn't use a glass window because this is vacuum inside. If they used glass, the heat would have softened it and it would pop in. But quartz is much higher melting, so it'll take the heat. Okay, so then they could look inside and see the color of that tantalum can. And the color of a heated body tells you its temperature. You know, red hot, white hot, blue hot. Okay, so they could tell the temperature by the color of this, and then they could measure something proportional to the amount of C1. So this is the plot. This is how much C1 they got, something proportional to it, right, at 2150 Kelvin to 2450 Kelvin. And they got from the slope of this line, plotting 1 over T versus the pressure, okay, they got that the heat was 171 kilocalories per mole, which you remember was the first spectroscopic value, but these Nobel laureates thought that that was wrong, that it was a lower value than that, 140 or 125. So this confirmed that it was 170 kilocalories per mole, and in fact, if you look at this heat, this table here, you can see that this value, C, is 170.9, and this was determined by William Chupka, who was in this department and who, until he died 3 years ago, used to come and tell people about this experiment, so that's why I told you about it today. And in fact, I noticed that some of you last lecture picked up there was a program out here. It wasn't for us, it was for a seminar that had happened, and it was a seminar in honor of William Chupka. So there's a little biography. I don't know if they're still out on the table outside the door or not. There may still be a few there. Okay, thanks for staying around for this.